Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 5 a.m. and that is on Saturday, November 18th. Well, the reason I'm recording the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes at this early hour on Saturday is because I was still feeling a bit jet-lagged when I got back to the hotel after the chart seminar yesterday, so I thought I'd do you a better service by giving myself a few hours sleep before jumping back on the plane. So, one of the big things that came out of the chart seminar over the last few days, we looked at lots of charts, and there was one big conclusion that I came to quite early on, and it was that all of the examples that people were using at the beginning were related to the technology sector. Now, it wasn't the technology sector that you might immediately think, oh, they were probably just asking for things like Apple and Google and Amazon. It, quite the opposite, in fact. Nobody asked to see Google or Amazon. We did look at some of those shares, like Facebook. But what was interesting was that it was all from the technology sector in one way, shape, or form. We looked at Intel and we looked at Cisco, and most, I think, obviously Cisco was in the news over the last few days as well. But this is obviously because technology has been doing fantastically well. And we then also looked at quite a lot of resources shares. And the resources sector has been, if we look at just a broad spectrum of shares within the sector, it's been spotty. When we look at things like gold and silver, they're range bound. That if we just look at these shares and take a big step back and don't think about the intraday minutiae, that they're range bound. That gold has been firming within this very inert short term range for the last couple of days. It was up yesterday, but it was not able to hold its highs on Wednesday. It was off its low on Thursday. But this is a very inert period of trading for gold, and that is not characteristic. This isn't something that gold does particularly often. Gold moves. It tends to go up and down quite a lot, and the fact that it has gone nowhere at all for almost a month is not characteristic, and it is also not likely to last. So, the balance of probabilities is that this is a base formation, but the base formation is probably much larger than most people realize. But one of the other big things, and I'll come back to the precious metals, but one of the big themes that became that I think we talked about was the subscription model. And I suppose I'm in a subscription business, so maybe I have a more of a sensitivity to this particular way of thinking than other people do. But the reality is that there are two big ways of thinking about it, and there's a discussion that I've had with a couple of subscribers who are rather large investors, and they've been pitched this idea by large investment houses trying to win their business, and it is simply this, that they need to be investing in rental properties because the millennial generation are never going to have the wherewithal to buy their own home. And that's something that has really stuck with me, because there is, at least to my ears, sort of an inherent unfairness to that. There's a cynicism about the fate of what we're talking about, millions of people, and that this is obviously the conclusion that has been drawn by investment professionals, because they see the this widening gap between rich and poor. They see that on average there's about 50% of the population in the USA are on incomes of less than $30,000 and have less than $500 in the bank. And that really helps to drive home the deductibles that you see on private health insurance in the order of $5,000. So people might have health insurance, but they can't afford to use it. And this is a rather profound problem. But what it also represents is if it is a fact, then it means that companies have to do something about it. So when a company looks at their people and looks at their products and looks at their customers, then they have to begin to think about what is it that they can do to win more business if the vast majority of people do not have the wherewithal for big outlays. And when you look at what people spend on their total expenditure, they mostly spend it on housing, but in the UK they spend more on transport than they do on housing, fuel and power. And that then suggests that when we hear people talking about the future of transportation, then this is obviously why they are looking at transportation as an area which could be disrupted by a non-ownership model. That you pay-to-play model would be something that could really take off in transportation, because the outlay that people have to make to own their own car is really quite high relative to the other things in their life that they have to pay. Even when you think about the down payment that people pay on a rental property, it's usually a month of their rent ahead, and as well as maybe a deposit. But when you have to buy a car, then it's more than that. So that would suggest that transportation is going to be one of those sectors that is constantly going to be up for grabs in terms of technological innovation, because they see it as a fat target. But there is another way of thinking about all of this, that when we look at what Adobe did, and Adobe was one of the first companies to adopt what is a subscription model. Now, one of the things that I tend to do, and we talk about commonality at the Chart Seminar a lot, because commonality is where we have really come up with the best, I think, probably the best investment ideas that that David and I have come up with over the last almost 20 years that we've been working together, has been to look at commonality, to go through lots and lots of charts, to find either the ones that are breaking out of base formations or those that are trending consistently higher, and then just group all the ones that are trending consistently higher and try and figure out what they have in common. Well, what Adobe did, you can see, and maybe if we look at this on a much longer term basis, we can see that Adobe did obviously frightfully well during the NASDAQ boom back in the 1990s. And then it went through a very choppy environment all the way from 2000 until all the way over here at about 2013. And that's also when the S&P 500 broke out. Well, they had a great product. It isn't Acrobat that everyone was using to look at PDFs, but they had Photoshop. And Photoshop is absolutely vital for online businesses, because when you have an online retail store, you're not selling products in the same way that you would in a physical store. What you are in fact selling is photos. And you need to have really good photos that are really attractive if you want to gain people's attention when they visit your site. So therefore, you can't have an online site if you don't use Photoshop. And that represents a really important aspect for the company. But the problem for them was that Photoshop was expensive, and it was really easy to pirate because it was on CD-ROMs. So what they did was they adopted a subscription model. They cut the price, and if you wanted to access the software, then you had to pay them every month. And what that did was it smoothened out their cash flow, because the classic way that a company used to work would have been that they would release their product, that they'd get an initial bump in sales, then they would have to continue to fix the bugs while they're coming up with the next one. And that led to very lumpy cash flows. They'd do really well for a couple of years, and then they'd go right back down for a couple of years, and then they'd do really well the next few years. But if you have a subscription model, what it does is that you don't get those lumpy cash flows to nearly the same extent. You build a dependency on your products that people that if you need to edit your photo, then you need to have Photoshop, and then that means that it becomes a dependency. It becomes almost like a utility-like experience. And the utility business has been employing a subscription model for the longest time. They obviously are providing something that is totally vital to everybody's lives, and that has contributed to, by and large, steady cash flows, very easily modelable yields, and then you generally get your reasonably consistent trends because they're providing a service that is vital to everyone's life. So we can think about then the distillation of the consumer experience down to a set of cash flows. That is exactly how that is why the hedge funds and large investors are looking at the at people's at people as cash flows, not as the retail experience, but as a major source of cash flow. And when you start to aggregate all of those cash flows, that is exactly what Blackstone did when they bought all those rental properties after the 2008 crisis, because they were thinking about a about the cash flow that would be would rise out of that sector. But then if we start to think about, well, what has Microsoft done? Well, Microsoft did exactly the same thing. What they did was they had their various Windows products, and it was a fantastically successful business, but very lumpy cash flows. And they adopted a subscription model a few years ago, and since then the price has done nothing but go higher. You used to buy your Windows and Office, and it represented a significant proportion of the cost of buying your computer. Well, that's not the case any longer. You get a 1 month free trial to Office 365, and then you pay them every month indefinitely. And that has smoothened out the cash flows. Well, it isn't simply that. Apple, with its iTunes, is adopting subscription models. So it is obviously still very much a hardware-driven business with the iPhone, but what they use their subscription business for and the iTunes store is as a an anchor for their customers. Then, if we look at the gaming sector, Activision Blizzard has also adopted this microtransaction and almost a subscription model that they've built into the games, that once you've bought the game, that you're really only starting on the consumer relationship, because there are all these additional add-ons that are highly desirable from the perspective of the participant that they will additionally pay for. And those what are considered loot boxes or downloadable content represent these very powerful ways of boosting and smoothening out the cash flow from the business, and it is exactly the same for all of them. So when we think about why is it that Adobe, which makes software for editing photos, and Activision Blizzard, which makes games, or Ubisoft in France, which makes games, or Take-Two Software, which makes games, then it isn't simply that they have similar businesses, they have broadly similar businesses, but they've all adopted a subscription model. And Netflix is also a subscription business. So then when you start to think about this, that it isn't simply that that hedge funds have suddenly come to the realization that people are cash flows, and that you need to be buying rental properties because that's all people have is their cash flow. They are not generating savings. It is actually that the corporate sector came to that conclusion years ago, that Amazon, with its Prime business, is another subscription model. And this is a theme that is permeating the entire equity class, that it represents the adoption of a completely different business model that companies have adopted and then have transformed their multiples. Because one of the great things about adopting a subscription model is that once you know what your growth is and you know what your subscription is, then you know what your revenues are going to be. And that's very important from the perspective of fundamental investors who are looking at the cash flow and trying to model what's going to happen next. If you've got really lumpy cash flows, then that doesn't allow you to justify a higher multiple. But if you've got visibility on the income stream, then that allows you to justify a higher multiple. And then when we think about just how high multiples are, well, obviously the there are a significant number of investors are looking at the valuation on the S&P 500, and what they're saying is that it isn't simply that technology has got a higher multiple, but that everything has a higher multiple. And there's some truth to that, but I think there is also the there was a report from GMO during the week, and the title on it was Fang Shmang. Now, that is we could talk for half an hour about the psychological components of writing such a headline when you're talking about one of the best performing sectors. They obviously don't own it, and obviously they don't want to own it because what one of the delegates said is, well, they're always bearish. And that's always the case, that there's always going to be somebody who's always bearish, and they will eventually, at some point, somewhere down the line, get vindicated. But there's no great deal of evidence that that vindication is going to happen right now. What I find most particularly interesting is that we have had so this subscription-based model is almost a direct function of what has happened as a result of quantitative easing. That, I think, has to be one of the things that we have to unpack. Because central banks have issued an awful lot of debt, and they have artificially reduced the interest rate so that we now have a situation where savers have, in many respects, been robbed. That when you think about all of the money that has been created, that most of it has gone to banks in terms of their reserves. It has helped to bail out the banks, but that savers who have money on deposit are getting nothing for it. And how is the regular person who has a small amount of money on deposit ever supposed to grow that quantity of cash with low interest rates? The vast majority of people are not going to be able to get to a point where they can do that if they don't ever get interest on their savings. And that's if we're looking at the political polarization that we have, that's got to be part of the reason. There is no way that that is simply a coincidence. That when we think about all of the money that has gone to bail out the banking sector, all of the money that has gone to save us from a depression, well, it saved the broad economy from a depression, but the problem was that it did so at the expense of savers. And the people that were most acutely affected by that were not the big savers, because the big savers are those that had the financial resources to benefit from the asset price inflation. But it was the savers that don't have a lot of money, that they might have some savings, but not enough to benefit from asset price inflation. And those people have been denuded of any potential for growth in their assets over the last decade. So when we think about what is the underlying reason behind this political polarization, well, this has got to be part of it. The distillation of the human experience to a set of cash flows is something that is obviously has been enormously beneficial from the perspective of corporations, and there is no sign yet that it is over, but that there is a component to it that is obviously not a great solution. And that if we are thinking about what it is that is likely to really create a source of volatility in future, well, then it's going to be something like that. That if more people are in rather dire situations where they are worried about meeting their obligations from all the additional cash flows that they now have. Because there is the other point, of course, that with an increasing number of companies that are releasing subscription models, then they are creating an increasing number of sources of demand for limited resources. And it means that people are increasingly having to choose about which services they are going to pay for on an ongoing basis. And when people have to make choices about what they have to buy or what they can have, when they would probably have been able to have the old version and use it well enough for a pretty significant period of time, then that represents a source of, I think, unsettlement. So then if we look at what's happening in the US, in the UK, in France, Italy, Spain, then in the Czech Republic, Poland, Hungary, Turkey, even in China, then we have to at least conclude that I think this political polarization that is increasingly evolving isn't simply a single country factor, but that it is happening in lots of different places. And when people want something and they want an improving standard of living, the vast majority of people are incapable of talking about risk-adjusted or inflation-adjusted returns. They are obviously not happy with the line that is trotted out, that you might not have as much money as you did in previous times, but you have a better standard of living now because technological innovation and the deflationary forces behind it mean that you can do more with less. So you don't. So then, of course, the subtext is that you don't need more money. So stop asking for it. Well, that's not a very happy situation for a lot of people. So the answer, of course, is that the regular person on the street just wants more money. And they don't care about whether it's on an inflation-adjusted return or not. And that is, I think, in a large part behind why we are getting an uptick in demand for things like the what we're now getting in the USA, which is lower taxes. So that is the first way that people ask for more money. They say, the government is taking too much of it, so I just want to keep more of my own money. And then we also have people that are talking about universal basic income as if it is some sort of panacea. And they never seem to highlight exactly where the money is going to come from. Then, of course, you have the people that are saying, well, I don't just want I don't just want a tax cut, but I want an end to globalization because all our jobs have gone overseas. So then that is another function of exactly the same root cause that there is a almost a jealousy that we could have not benefited when someone else has. And that represents another issue, because when we think about all of these potential solutions, there are some on the left, there are some on the right, and the distance between the left and the right is growing progressively wider, that eventually this situation is going to break, that the political polarization is going to become increasingly more profound until people get what they want. And this is, I think, going to be a big issue for the USA as they push through their tax cuts. And they have the potential to, at least, I think, to arrest what is the political polarization if they can boost growth. If they can boost growth over a couple of years, then, and more people are back at work, well, then they might be able to get somewhat, things might tone down somewhat. But so far, the political polarization that we're getting in the UK, where you have this everyone worrying about Brexit almost 24/7 and thinking about what the solution is, what the benefits are, what the challenges will be, is also going to have a political upset. That eventually, whenever the deal is done, the government is likely to fall because there are so many people with competing ideas of what to do afterwards. And it's also going to contribute to political polarization in Europe. So these all represent issues, and the solutions are inflationary. That in the USA, if they do in fact push through their the tax cut, and it got a big boost on Friday with the House bill getting passed, well, then the question is that if they're going to have a pro-growth strategy when you already have almost zero unemployment, or 4% unemployment, which is akin to full employment, then isn't that directly inflationary? Government bond yields have been going sideways since 2011. So this is already a 6-year base formation. And the yield was lower in here this week, and it is back below that 2.4% level. So there is the potential that we could have some additional back and forth. But if this yield is breaking up and out of this base formation, then we can conclude that we're back in an inflationary cycle. And we're probably not there just yet, because we're only really at the dawn of the changing of the guard in terms of what the central bank balance sheets are doing. When we look at those long-term charts for central bank balance sheets, and the on aggregate, it is still rising. I think that this is something that we really have to at least consider, that there is $19.67 trillion sitting on the balance sheets of the major central banks around the world. And capital is both global and mobile, and it has contributed to massive asset price inflation. And the Federal Reserve is beginning to reduce the size of its balance sheet, and it doesn't have much choice because it's got over $400 billion worth of debt that is going to be maturing next year. So what it looks like they're going to do is allow half of that total to mature, and they're going to reinvest the other half. So this is a halfway house measure. They are simply adopting a necessary strategy to try and manage this big headwind of a chunk of supply that is going to come back into the market next year. If they are refinancing at 200 billion of it, well, That's a big chunk of supply. And it does represent a headwind for the bond market next year. And it could necessitate that yields could push higher. Well, the ECB is talking about tapering its quantitative easing program, and that tapering could take a year. So that means that the ECB's balance sheet will continue to expand until the taper is done. Japan is running both fiscal and monetary policy stimulus concurrently, so that continues to represent a source of liquidity, not just for Japan, but for globally. And China is still on a stimulus pattern or path. If that's indeed the case, then while we're getting small changes to monetary policy, this trend is continuing higher. And as long as that remains the case, then we can probably continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. When central bank balance sheets are contracting, well, then that would be a very different story. Then you have the total return on the 10-year treasury. And perhaps the most important thing is that this trend is no longer consistent. And that's all we need to conclude. The one of the most consistent trends in history is no longer consistent. It has lost upward momentum, and it has been going higher since 1983. But there is a clear loss of momentum. And if that is indeed the case, then the risk that this is top formation development has increased. That doesn't mean that the top formation has been completed. It hasn't. We're still at a point where this index could rally from the region of the trend mean. It could bounce from here. And if it does, well, then that is going to suggest that yields will come back down and that we are going to be in the base formation for somewhat longer in terms of treasury yields. That would also represent a tailwind for equity markets. So there are issues coming up with the bond market. We know that there's going to be a big chunk of supply coming out next year, but the big question is just how stimulative is the US tax cut going to be. If we get a short, sharp bump in growth, well, that's going to be positive for the stock market for as long as it lasts. But something that's also been happening this week is that 2-year yields have been running up. And that's a pretty big move. That the yield has gone from 155 and change up to 172 this month. And the pace of the advance is picking up. Investors are beginning to realize that the Federal Reserve is serious about raising interest rates, and 2-year yields are now up to 1.25%. Well, the Fed funds rate right now is 1.25%. So they've now priced in that there's going to be two interest rate hikes within the next 2 years. And that is up from only one interest rate hike in the next 2 years, just about 6 weeks ago. So they are beginning to price this in. And what that is contributing to is a contraction in the yield curve spread. So the yield curve is now down to 62 basis points. And that's only 62 basis points away from zero. And the pace of the advance, or excuse me, the pace of the contraction is picking up. So the yield curve has been an inverted yield curve has been one of the most reliable lead indicators for future recessions in the last 50 odd years. And it can offer a lead indicator for anything from 6 to 18 months. And on its current trajectory, it could be going negative at some point next year. And that would suggest that the next recession would be sometime in late 2018 or sometime in 2019. And considering that there is such a large amount of debt needs to be refinanced by the Fed, next year and again in 2019. And that is only the treasury debt and the mortgage debt. But also, we have to consider that there is an enormous amount of corporate debt that has also been taken out. And also, that represents a big chunk that needs to be refinanced in 2019 and 2020. So, if we had to think about where are the problems going to come from the massive amount of debt that has been issued in the last decade, well, it's usually again, and this is again another example of the cash flow business, that the vast majority of companies can pay their monthly or their semi-annual coupon payments in much the same way that people will be able to pay for their monthly Microsoft bill. But they usually don't have the wherewithal to buy the product outright. So it is when they have to pay back the principal that they refinance the debt. And then that raises their refinancing costs if we are back in an environment where interest rates are higher than they were when that debt was issued. And that is something that could create a recession. And but again, we can rally significantly between now and then, because what we can also think about is that the pace of the advance is starting to pick up. So if I look at the Nasdaq 100, and it had its higher reaction low back in early 2009 when the S&P 500 was making new lows. That was its relative strength, and it represented a temporal designation so that we can call it a leader. And it is somewhat overbought relative to the trend mean right now by about, let's just say, 600 points on a 6,000 point index. So it's about 10% overextended relative to the trend mean. Well, ideally, it should pause and consolidate above 6,000 and unwind some of that overbought condition, and that would set it up for the next upward leg. And that would be perhaps the most benign environment. But it might not do that. It might simply accelerate higher. And if it does, well, that is going to represent a trend ending. That when a consistent trend, and I think this was a reasonably consistent trend, and we had a wobble in 2015 and 2016. And then the pace of the advance really, really improved. That we had a consistent advance between 2013 and 2015, and then we had some really choppy action, which did have top formation characteristics, but then it broke up again and it trended even more consistently. Now, if something trends even more consistently, that tells us that the imbalance between supply and demand has grown even wider. And that happens because of weight of money. So, where are we in terms of the psychological perception stages, in terms of this almost 10-year bull market? And we have to at least consider that we are well into acceptance and potentially on the way to euphoria. So, we know what the really bullish stories are, that companies like Amazon and Google and Facebook are dominating the world, that they are cannibalizing existing businesses, and that eventually they are going to be the only companies left standing. And that's an incredibly powerful narrative, which is leading to panic buying, that people are simply throwing in the towel, and most particularly after something like General Electric can collapse in the space of a very short period of time. General Electric this week extended its decline and is now accelerating lower. So that this is a very large company which has gone through a very difficult time. And this is not Valeant Pharmaceuticals. This is a major industrial business, but it is now going to be at risk of being broken up. And that suggests that we're going to be in for a much more choppy environment. But I think it is getting progressively interesting since it has the moving average is at 25 and the price is at 18. That it is becoming rapidly overextended relative to the trend mean. But because it is the virtual epitome of a blue chip, its decline is almost like a catalytic event in terms of people reaching the conclusion that they are investing in the wrong game, that they need to invest in technology. So because it is the only thing that is generating these strong and reliable cash flows, whereas GE is obviously having some difficulty. So there is the potential that these stock market advances pick up pace, and we are getting the Wall Street leash effect is really quite important. Now the Dow Jones was down 100 points on Friday, and having been up on Thursday, so we're getting at least some pause of consolidation. But we have to at least pay some attention to the size of the consolidation. The range, the high was at 23,600, and the index closed out on Wednesday at 23,271. So it's a 400-point range on a 23,000-point index. That these ranges have been really quite small, but even a reasonably sized range for the index is anything up to about 800 or 900 points. So this is still a very is an environment that is really plagued by a lack of volatility. And volatility is I think not just low, but that it is so incredibly low, it is also a function of this low interest rate environment. The VIX index has been subject to this buy the dips or indeed sell the rallies environment now for much of the last year, that every time it has one of these mini spikes higher, that it cannot sustain that move, and algorithmic trading systems start coming in to buy the dip. And they can buy the dip on a risk parity strategy, because what it also necessitates is that they are buying bonds. So that is also why the government bond yield has been coming down this week. It has been because risk parity strategies buy both bonds and equities to lay off the risk one against the other, because they can match the volatility measures. So the MOVE index, which is the Merrill Lynch Option Volatility Index on Treasuries, is also at historic lows. And both of these are functions of the extraordinarily low interest rate environment, which has also created this very liquid environment in terms of flow. Again, this is also a function of this distillation of cash flows down to their base instinct, that these are simply not they're not talking about the cash flows from people, just simply the flows of money. And that also means that these strategies are earnings agnostic. I think that's incredibly important to remember, that when we think about some of the contradictions that you get in every major bull market, that in the late 1980s, the Imperial Palace in Japan, in Tokyo, was worth more than the entire state of California. Well, we look back and think that's absolutely ridiculous. That earnings don't matter was almost a meme in the 1990s. And obviously, that is nonsense. And even in 2008, it was that everyone can hedge their default risk. Well, not everyone can hedge their default risk. As it turns out, what happens is that they simply just push the default risk onto the government and the people. And what we now have is this: if we have passive investing, which where people are simply buying the index, and we have the the risk parity strategy, which is basically moving on flow and twinning volatility between bonds and equities. But these are pervasive strategies, and these quantitative strategies that are momentum based are earnings agnostic. That's the same as saying in the 1990s that earnings don't matter. Earnings obviously do matter. And when we look at the companies that have done so fantastically well, but don't in fact have any earnings, well then we have to think about Tesla. Tesla is the company that is a media magnate that has done better than anybody else at attracting additional revenues. But they don't make any money. And their earnings are negative. They had one positive earnings quarter in October of 2016. And since then, their spend has in fact been increasing. Well, this is a B minus rated credit. And Ethiopia, which is a country with improving governance and has the ability to tax its citizens, is also a B rated credit. They have similar yields as well. I think Tesla is at a Rubicon at around $300. If it can bounce here, well then the merry-go-round will persist for a while longer. But the potential that they are going to be able to deliver on their production targets is a big ask. And they have got a lot to prove. If it fails to sustain the move above 300, well, then that's going to be potentially a canary in the coal mine for the high yield sector. The high yield spread index is something that I'm watching rather closely because high yield does very well when you have an environment where interest rates are low and there's abundant liquidity, where if you want to borrow money for anything, that the money is available. But they are uniquely sensitive to interest rate hikes. And this index has been range bound in a very tight range just about all year. And if it starts to trend higher, well, what that suggests is that there is an increasing lack of faith in the potential that these high yield companies are going to be able to pay back their debt. And that represents a headwind because if high yield, which are often high growth companies, have issues paying back their debt, well, then they're going to let people go. And then you get an uptick in unemployment and you have the conditions for a recession. So I'm watching it quite closely because if we start to see it trending higher, then we have to be really quite alert to the consistency characteristics of the equity markets. Now, oil prices are currently at $62.72. And that was an upside key reversal on Friday. So it has bounced from above the $60 area, and this looks like still a bullish environment. What I find particularly interesting is that we have Norway this week saying that they want to exit their positions of in oil companies. Abu Dhabi has already sold off its retail gasoline business, and Saudi Aramco wants to IPO as well. So we are seeing these massive sovereign wealth funds that have become so disillusioned with their business that they have been pummeled by low prices, by the growing ambivalence towards fossil fuels from the environmental agency, and also that they see the innovation that's happening in technology, and they have reached the conclusion that they're in the wrong business. And prices are going up. So There is certainly a divergence there, that there's probably nobody thinks right now that oil prices are at a point where they can sustain a rally. We know that there is a source of additional supply in the Permian Basin that is being ramped up right now with prices above $60, and it takes 3 or 4 months to get there. But on the other side of the supply-demand equation, Venezuela is going bust, and they represent a major source of supply. Now, obviously, their supply has deteriorated considerably over the last few years, so one might argue that just how important is that? But then we also have Saudi Arabia, and a point that I've been making for years now is that you cannot simply assess Saudi Arabia from the perspective of a Western constitutional democracy. It's a feudal society, and throughout history, in feudal societies, when the realm faces a challenge, then the aristocrats, who in normal circumstances are afforded a great deal of leeway, are called to the capital and told that they need to provide treasure, arms, and soldiers to defend the realm. And those that do and eventually prevail, then they are afforded much more leeway and much greater wealth in future. But those that rebel are generally denuded of their titles. And that is exactly what we're getting in Saudi Arabia right now, that they are being told that the country faces profound long-term challenges and they need to contribute, and that if they can do that and everything is resolved favorably, they'll come out of it much better off. But now is the time for sacrifice. And considering the fact that Saudi Arabia's population, 50% of it is less than 25 years old, and you had to make a decision about where do you go for the money, well, you go to the people who've got it. And that represents the large ranks of the aristocrat class. But what that is also a function of is that Saudi Arabia is in the throes of this generational divide, because the people that are over 25, that 50% of the population, have benefited enormously from the largesse that oil has afforded the country. And those that are under 25 have no chance of the same standard of living that their parents enjoyed. So that represents really quite a significant challenge. And a despotic regime usually will only has two ways of keeping the crowd under control. Well, the first is bread and circuses. So they're going to build a city of the future where everyone is going to live happily ever after. And they are going to stoke nationalism by fighting wars. And they're already engaged in wars in Yemen, Iraq, Syria, and potentially the new up-and-coming one will be in Lebanon. And the enemy, as always, is the historic enemy, which is Shiism, and represented by Iran. So that represents a potential powder keg in terms of geopolitical tension. So that has to be at least balanced against the potential that supply can increase from US onshore, domestic, unconventional sources. And prices are continuing to march higher. And that does represent a medium-term challenge. Not yet. If prices move back up towards $100, then that is going to represent a challenge for the global economy. And realistically, that is potential. That is a potential possibility. We often see that resources rally into the final stages of either medium-term or secular bull markets. And the resources sector is rallying. It's not rallying with nearly the same commonality as the technology sector, But it is rallying. And the ASX 300 resources index in Australia might have been a little bit softer this week, but it remains on a recovery trajectory. If that's the case, then what we can anticipate is that we have to then, perhaps not, rather than say anticipate, we have to consider where are we in terms of the long-term cycle. Well, the long-term cycle is a lot longer than most people consider. That this is the Dow-Gold ratio, and there are 36 years, 35 or 36 years between the important peaks. Well, the last peak was in 1999. So the next peak is going to be somewhere between 2034 and 2036. And we're currently in 2017. So that's an additional 17 years from now. That means we're at about the halfway point. And could we get a wobble? Is there any secular bull market that has not been punctuated by a recession from time to time? Well, there hasn't been. It's normal to have recessions. But this is the important point, that if we're coming to the latter stages of a medium-term bull market, we're not even halfway through the secular bull market yet. And that suggests that when we get a recession, it's going to represent a very important buying opportunity. And that is something that we do have to bear in mind, that it is unlikely to represent the kind of challenge that we had in 2000 or in 2008. That this is a different scenario. And that brings me back to gold prices. Because gold has been exhibiting relative strength compared to both silver and platinum. And it is firming here from the region of the trend mean. It was able to finish on the upper side of its range for the week. And when we look at that on a 10-year basis, it has been range-bound for almost 2 years already. The most important thing that has happened on the chart was that really impressive breakout in early 2016. That had type 2 bottoming characteristics, and so often after a type 2 bottom, you get a period of right-hand extension. And that is what this looks like for gold. And that suggests that the most likely scenario is that it will break above $1,400. And it could potentially do even better than that, that it could get up to $1,600 or even $1,800 over the course of a recovery scenario within a medium-term advance. But the likelihood of it trending significantly higher beyond that is not nearly as high as it was back in early 2000. That was a period where gold was able to put in positive performance for 10 consecutive years. And that's unlikely in the current environment because of that Dow-Gold ratio, that the secular move in gold ended in 2011. And now we're in a period that is going to be much more short-term in nature. That doesn't mean that gold can't have very impressive moves. One of the reasons that people invest in precious metals is because after they've been ranging for a long time, they get explosive breakouts. And gold has been ranging for a long time already. So it does have the potential to garner investor interest when it eventually starts to move. And potentially also when people start looking for safe havens as we move into an environment where there is the potential for the stock markets to accelerate higher and for inflation to start to pick up again. I think that is one of the things that people will be looking on gold as a hedge for. And I did mention earlier that we have the Wall Street leash effect, and it's important that Europe is starting to play catch-up, and it has outperformed in terms of growth. The Stock 600 has not yet completed a move above 600, but it is likely that it will do that. Then the FTSE 100 did break up out of its 17-year range, and it has so far held that move. the Taiwanese market has also broken up and out of an extraordinarily long-term range. The Korean market broke up out of a 7-year range. The Thai market broke up out of, I think it's like a 3 or 4 year range. And we can see what the commonality is in all of these. But perhaps the most important one is Japan. Japan has got two, I think, really important points going for it. The first is that the Bank of Japan is running a very loose monetary policy, and the government are running loose fiscal policy. So that represents a tailwind for asset prices. The second is that because they are committed to these policies, that we have the potential for inflation to start to pick up. And Japan has now broken above the 20,000 level on the Nikkei, and that's a big move. The TOPIX index has been trading below 1750 for an awfully long time, and it is now right at the upper side of that level. It finished out this week at 1763. There is the real possibility that Japan is now on the cusp of breaking up and out of its long-term base formation. It's not leading because it has obviously had some challenges, but I think there is an increasing realization internationally that the market is not expensive and that it has the potential to outperform over the long term. One of the points that I've made, and I think it is it makes at least some sense, is that Japan tried everything they could to try and stoke inflation during one of the greatest periods of disinflation on Earth. We have to at least consider, could they, it doesn't matter what they tried, could they have succeeded? And that we'll never know the answer to that. But they've been trying for longer than any other country to stoke inflation. And if the global economy moves back onto an inflation footing, then the potential is that Japan is where we'll see some of the first evidence of that coming through in terms of asset price inflation. And I think that is potentially what we will see over the medium term. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend. And I'm hoping that this broadcast will be able to upload from the hotel here. But if it doesn't, I will upload it when I get back home later on. Well, it's probably going to be night on Saturday in the UK when I can get that done. And I wish all the best to all of you.